Eclectic music, engaging talk.
Since 1969.
Listen live now at KUCI.org.
88.9 FM.
KUCI Irvine.
Good morning. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Janine. This is Get the Funk Out. If you're new to my show, you can visit the show blog, which is getthefunkoutshow.kuci.org. So first up on my show is author Tom Seaman. And he's written a memoir called Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. I want to tell you a little bit about it before I bring him on. On Bronson Street, in the projects of Toledo, Ohio, in a small house occupied by a family of 14, Tom Seaman starts a very important list. Animals I want to see one day. And what begins as a dream of travel to far-flung places becomes a roadmap out of Tom's poverty-stricken neighborhood to Yale, Harvard, and beyond. But despite Bronson Street's hardships and crime, it's also something of a mythical street, populated by unforgettable people who share food, protect each other, and give surprising gifts of beauty and merriment, proving that the bonds of community and friendship, often across racial and social lines, can bridge any divide and transcend what many of us are taught to believe about each other. Tom Seaman is joining us now. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, Janine. How are you?
Good. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
When I was reviewing your book, I was blown away by so many bits and pieces of your backstory. When you were little, did you feel like you had this resilience? Did you have this vision for your future?
Yes, I definitely did. I definitely dreamed big as a young child, and I thought I could be anything I wanted to be. You know, I say in the book that I wanted to be the heavyweight champion of the world like Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
Or the president of the United States, or the richest man in the world, all things that are incredibly unattainable, especially given that I wasn't even a boxer, right? But I had these ideas that I could be anything I wanted to be just through hard work and dedication.
What was it like for you as a young child? Because I didn't share too much with the listeners. Tell us a little backstory.
Yeah, so I grew up in the projects in Toledo, Ohio, in a family of 14. All those children were born within 15 years, so we were all living for decades together as 14 people in this house in the projects, on welfare, on food stamps. I had a saintly mother, a fantastic mother, who's still alive at 92.
Wow.
And I had a very difficult alcoholic father who, in addition, separate from his alcoholism, I think was a very mean man. I think he didn't like his life, didn't love his life, and took it out on his family, but, you know, a very unhappy guy. But my mother, you know, pulled it together, kept the family together. That was one of her big goals, and was just created wonder for us as children. And then I would say the one of the biggest things in my life that I've only realized by writing this book is the many incredible acts of kindness that were done for me along the way, mm-hmm. that most of them being small things, some of them being big, but when you added them all up, they added up to a life. You know, and so I think writing the book has actually made me a kinder person with that realization.
Sure. Was there a point where you were very bitter about your childhood?
No. When someone said to me as an adult, you know, how did you deal with your dysfunctional childhood? When I told them the story, mm-hmm. I said, oh, I didn't have a dysfunctional childhood. I had a happy childhood. So I've always been a happy person. I woke up even as a child every day happy. Once again, I think a lot of that is due to what my mother did, but I also just think I have a happy outlook, not an effusive happy outlook, like
sure.
I wouldn't say, oh, this is an incredibly happy guy.
Yes.
But I'm very, very happy with my life, and as an adult, I live in great gratitude for how it's all come out, because I realize, you know, I've achieved a lot since those days, and there's a certain satisfaction and I think confidence that comes from doing that.
At what point did your life start turning a corner as far as, you know, things were really changing? And the other question I have is, your siblings, did you find yourself dreaming big and maybe they didn't have as big a dreams, or were you doing similar things? I know that's two questions.
Yes. So I think there were a few important things that happened along the way. For example, somebody, you know, gave a donation to our school that they could send two kids away to summer camp for 2 weeks up in Michigan. I grew up in Ohio, and me and my brother were chosen. Things like that that was started to open up the world for me. But I would say the biggest turning point came when I was in the eighth grade. My mother had gotten us to go to a Catholic school in the neighboring neighborhood to ours. I grew up in a mostly black neighborhood, and the neighborhood next to ours was mostly white, not high-end white or anything, but, you know, a Polish, Eastern European kind of neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And we got to go to the school there for free as long as we worked at the school. So from a very young age, I was a janitor. But when I was in eighth grade, all the siblings before me had gone to the public high school, which was not a great high school, frankly. And I always had this image of myself doing something more than that. And I knew that the Catholic schools in Toledo were the better schools. So I calculated that if I kept my paper out and if I worked odd jobs as I always did, like shoveling snow and things like that for people, and if I worked at the school, I could afford Central Catholic, which was the least expensive private school in Toledo. And so I took the Catholic school's admissions test, and I checked that my results would go to the box for Central Catholic.
Okay.
And then I saw the boxes for the other high schools, and one of them is called St. Francis de Sales, which was known in my neighborhood as the sissy school because you wore a coat and tie every day to St. Francis. But it was also known as the college prep school, you know, the hard school. And so I knew about it, so I checked the box for St. Francis as well. And a few weeks later, I was called to the principal's office, Sister Ann's office, and I thought I had done something wrong, but there was a man to meet me, and his name was Father McMenamin, and he was from St. Francis de Sales, and he said, "Tom, tell me, why did you check the box for Central?" And I explained how I had done this calculation. And by the way, I did this calculation completely on my own. I didn't ask my parents,
"Amazing,
do you think I can pull this off?"
Yes.
Or I didn't ask my teachers. I was very self-motivated, self-driven kid. And I explained why I could afford Central, and he was impressed that I had done this. And he said, "Why did you check St. Francis?" And I said, "Well, you know, I know it's the college prep school, and I really want to achieve a lot in life, but I shouldn't have checked it because I can't afford it. I'm sorry." And he said, "Well, what if I told you that you can go to St. Francis because I can give you a full scholarship?"
Whoa.
And why was that such a turning point? Because when I got to St. Francis, so I had, you know, was in my neighborhood before that, and I was starting to do some bad things with a couple guys I was hanging around with. And when I get to St. Francis, I'm put in the top homeroom because my test score was high enough to put me in the top homeroom. And I'm immediately with the nerds. Now, I'm also a pretty big football player, so I could have chosen the groups that I would have hung around with.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hung around with the guys in my class.
That's great.
And we became like a band of five guys that did everything together. And I would have conversations with them, you know, at lunch or when we're going out at night in cars later in high school, you know, about politics, about religion, about why are we here, you know, why did God make us and things like that. Conversations that I just never had at home or with my friends in the neighborhood. And this changed me so much. And I also I was a very competitive kid. Well, now I was competing with top students at St. Francis to achieve the best grades and the best class ranking and all that. So I was exposed to this much higher level of academic competition, which drove me to do better and better and become a better and better student, which was very key in my life.
Incredible. It's so interesting how we have choices. You could go with the football players, you could go with this group, that group, and who you chose changed the trajectory of your life.
Yes, and I'm still really close to the group of five. We just had a reunion up in Maine a few months. We have a house in Maine, mm-hmm. and we had a, you know, reunion on the lake with the big fires outside at night, you know, all five of us there.
I love it.
And it was just, you know, so I'm still close to them. They've all achieved good things in their life. But in response to your earlier question, by the way, about my siblings,
yes,
I would say that there's been a great variation of socioeconomic outcomes with my family. Everyone is happy. We get together every Thanksgiving. We don't have a lot of animosities, but we have definitely different outcomes. And I would say several of my siblings were really driven. I was really driven. And we've had some really, you know, great outcomes and some, you know, some more average outcomes, I would say. But everyone is happy. Everyone has achieved something. And no one is in the projects, and no one is on welfare. So, and no one has substance abuse problems, which is, I think, a very great outcome.
Yes. And I got a sense that you weren't a child that felt like you needed materialistic things. You could be happy where you were, to
a
degree.
Yes, I saw the world. I saw the world with wonder. So I describe in the beginning of the book when we move from Ravine Park Village, which is an area of the projects in East Toledo, which, you know, is very unattractive. There's a picture of it in the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. There's, like, no trees. The buildings are brick and old with flat roofs. They look like prison buildings almost. And there were three or four or five to a building, depending on which building you were in, and it was a cluster of buildings, like a neighborhood. When we move, because our family is so large, and I think my mom had 9 children at the time we moved, and then she went on to have 12, when we move to a separate standing house in a new area of the projects called what we call Bronson Street, but it's technically called the Pulley Homes. And when we get there, there's a field behind our house, and we go into this field. And later in life, I realize it's just a trash heap, right? It's an area where people dump stuff. There's an old refrigerator door. There's bricks. There's trash. But I go out there with a couple of my siblings that first day, and I see it with wonder. You know, we turn over a piece of plywood, mm-hmm. and there's a snake, or there's roly-polies, or there's a rat. And I begin this list of animals I have seen, which I keep for a long time. And then eventually when I go to that summer camp, I actually lose the list in the river on a canoe trip.
Okay.
And so I start a new list, which is called Animals I Want to See One Day. And this is more of a forward-looking list, obviously. I didn't realize it at the time, but it's kind of significant that I started more of a forward-looking list,
mm-hmm.
that looked out into the world and sort of implicitly implied that I was going to be able to do these things, go out into the world and see these animals in the wild, even though I had no means at the time or no, you know, indication that I was going to achieve enough that I could afford to go out into the world and see these animals in the wild. But I did achieve that, and I have seen a lot of really cool animals in the wild as a result.
I love that. But maybe that list was a way to keep you going, to dreaming and, you know, forward thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, looking back, I didn't realize at the time, but it's like a metaphor for all my, you know, ideas that I would be successful, all my very positive outlook on the world and my very aspirational nature. Yes.
Because I could see that being a list of things I want to do or places I want to see, and you making that happen. That just seemed to be the type of kid you were.
Yes, yes. But I always loved animals, you know, so
mm-hmm.
it's interesting that rather than listing, oh, I want to become this or that, the list that I did keep was this list of animals I want to see. Yeah.
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 I want to ask you about the picture you chose for the front of your book. You were about 5 there? 6?
Six, I think,
okay.
Yeah.
Where was that taken?
So that was taken inside the house in the projects, and it's cut out of a larger photo, which is me with my siblings. And if you look to the left of it, there's like an old wooden playpen, which we all grew up in. My mother would place us as babies in that playpen. And at the time, you know, she always had new babies. She had, you know, kept having children on and on.
Mm-hmm.
So we always had a new baby. And so the playpen is next to me, and one of my sisters is on the other side. And I just thought that the photo, when you look at it, shows this boy looking out directly at the camera with a sense of purpose, it looks like, you know, whether that's exactly what really happened when the photo was taken.
Yes.
But it shows the kind of kid I was in a certain way.
Yes. No, it definitely does. I loved it. At first I thought, oh, is this like a little class picture? And I thought, oh, it could be with his siblings.
Yeah, a lot of people have said that. Is that a class picture? But the answer is no. It's actually in the house with my siblings at the time.
So tell me about your path to, because I look at your life as very nonlinear, that built resilience along the way in so many ways. But tell me how or when your aspirations for college and how you landed into these prestigious schools.
Yeah, so when I was in high school, I began to have even bigger dreams. And, you know, just like I drove myself to go to the best high school I could think of, I was driving myself to go to the best college I could think of. And at the time, you know, back in the 70s, information was less available. And all I knew was the best schools in my mind were Ivy League schools like Yale and Harvard and Princeton, and so I wanted to go there. And I was speaking to a priest at my high school who was the person that would help counsel you to college. And at the time, my high school was placing kids at really good schools. It had almost 100% kids go to college, but they weren't really, you know, today all these schools reach out to those tremendous schools in the East and West Coast, but in those days it was less common. And I told the priest, hey, I think I want to try for the Ivy League schools. And at first, he was mildly dismissive, you know, in the book. He says, that's quite a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
But then he could tell, and I was very close to him. He had sort of adopted my group of five as one of his causes, and he would take us special places. You know, he took us as a group to Greektown in Detroit to have dinner. He took me, to art house movies at a local junior college called Owens Tech.
That's great.
I would go see these very unusual old movies with him and things like that. But anyhow, at first he was dismissive, but then he saw that I was serious, and he said he would help me, and he did help me. And I think my story that I wrote for my application was, you know, about my upbringing and things. And those were the days when I think the colleges were just beginning to really get into that, you know, first generation to college and all that. And so I was admitted to several Ivy schools, and I went to Yale.
That's amazing. I mean, maybe to you it wasn't so amazing. That's where I wanted to go.
Well, it was a pretty good day when I got those acceptances, yes,
I'll
I have
say.
To say. It opened up the world to me. You know, I knew that I was then going out into the world, and I always felt in school like I was in the best place I could be
mm-hmm.
at that point in my life. And so then I applied myself very severely at Yale to my studies
mm-hmm.
And was successful there, but there are some moments that you'll see in the book where, you know, I have moments of doubt or difficulty where I'm sitting at my desk crying because it's so hard, and I feel so much weight is on me, because if I screw up this opportunity that I've been given, the result won't be what I want.
It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I pressured myself a lot.
Where do you think that came from?
Well, one place, I mean, you know, it's the old question about nature versus nurture, right? How much of it was in me when I was born
mm-hmm.
versus how much of it was did I learn along the way based on how I was raised? And, you know, we all 12 of us were raised by the same parents, but we all had different influences. We all had different friends. We had different people. We had teachers with whom we were the teacher's pet in some cases and in other cases not, et cetera. So we had different confidence shown in us along the way. So we were raised the same but not the same. And I think the biggest thing I would point out is my mother, who was not only a tremendously hard worker. I mean, if you think about, you know, what you have to do for children, you know, she was doing loads and loads of wash every day without a dryer, and she would hang the wash outside. And in the winter, she would hang them outside, and they would freeze solid, and she would bring them in and thaw them in the kitchen, which was the small little space,
mm-hmm.
and then take them back out, and her hands would crack and be bloody from the exposure of going in and out with these wet and frozen items. And that's just one thing she did every day. She cooked meals every day. She cleaned every day. She was a tremendously hard worker. But in addition to that, she was a person who went the extra mile. And that, I think, was an example that I didn't realize at the time that I was watching. She would not just bake cookies, but she would bake special cookies where she would roll out the dough and make these tiny triangles and put a little piece of apricot in the middle and fold them over, each one. And as soon as she finished these dozens and dozens of cookies for us, we would devour them and her artistry would disappear right then. And why would you go that extra mile to do that for us? And the same with meals and the same with sewing for us, where she would make my sister's dresses because she couldn't afford to buy them. You know, we lived in all donated clothes.
Mm-hmm.
We never bought clothes. So she would, you know, put a piece of cardboard in our shoe when we got a hole in the shoe. And we actually didn't want to kneel down at church because we were concerned that people behind us would see it.
Would notice,
She was just and she's still alive at 92 and still going strong.
And she was never bitter or angry or anything about that she had a life of 14 kids.
I mean, she was, as said in the book, she seemed to be a sea of calm, but later in life she admitted that she often cried herself to sleep at night, I think more because of how my father was than because of the kids, you know?
Yeah, I would imagine.
The kids were all, luckily, well-behaved, no real big problems, certainly some problems. Like my brother had rheumatic fever for a year, which is a serious health challenge that, once again, at the time, you had no idea how much this must have been stressing her. So she had some challenges along the way, but mostly it was my father who was the challenge, and obviously constantly money was the challenge, which occupies most people's lives so fully, right? The concern about money every day.
Yeah.
She had that worry all the time.
You might have mentioned this in the book, but I'm going to ask, was she a very religious woman?
She was religious in the sense, you know, Dostoevsky says in The Brothers Karamazov, he talks about some people want this life where another entity makes a lot of decisions so that you don't have to make those. And the church is an example of an institution that does that, right? It tells you what the rules are, and if you follow those rules, you'll go to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my mom had so much going on in her life, and she had been raised quite Catholic, that she was that kind of Catholic, where she followed the rules, but she couldn't tell you all about the Bible or something like that. But
sure.
She went to church every week. We all did. You know, when I was in grade school, we would go every day. So we were raised fairly religiously, and there's a fair amount about that in the book, in the way that I was, you know, frequently questioning things in the church, not questioning the overall faith, but questioning things in the church, particularly about the concept that we were taught very heavily as children that God was an all-just God. And I would look around and say, how can he be an all-just God if there's all these injustices around us?
Mm.
So I questioned a lot of things from a young age, and that appears in the book as well.
I just want to...
I was an odd child. I was an odd child.
I don't think odd in a bad way.
Right, no. Right. It turned out well.
Yeah. I want to just mention before we wrap up, listeners can hear a little bit more about you. I'm going to read your bio briefly. I've been speaking with Tom Seaman. He has a book out called Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. Tom grew up in a family of 14, as he mentioned earlier, on welfare and food stamps in the projects of Toledo, Ohio. He went on to own and lead several businesses. He earned a BA in economics from Yale, where he rode on the crew team and graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa, before going on to earn his Juris Doctor at Harvard Law. He currently serves on the board of directors of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Boston and the board of trustees of the Museum of Fine Arts Boston. He funded a scholarship that actively seeks disadvantaged students to attend St. Francis, is it DeSales?
DeSales,
High School in Toledo, the same school that generously gave him a scholarship and that he credits for helping him fulfill his dream of attending a top college. He has worked across the globe, lived in 5 countries, and traveled all to over 100. He makes his home in Massachusetts with his wife, 4 children, 3 dogs, and a cat. And before we wrap, how did you end up residing in Boston? Or Massachusetts?
I worked for McKinsey & Company, which is a very large consulting firm.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working in Europe, and I met my wife, who was in the Russian office. She's American, but she speaks Russian. And I met her through McKinsey and eventually married her. And she comes from this area. I had gone to Harvard, so I knew Boston well. I think it's just a fantastic city. So after I sold a business that I had founded with some McKinsey colleagues in Berlin, Germany, which we ran for a while and sold, we could move anywhere back to the U.S. And we decided to move back here where she is from. So we live 1 mile from my parents-in-law, which is great.
That is wonderful. And Tom, yeah. Where can people find out more about you and your book?
Well, the book is available on all the sites that sell books, even as far as Target, Walmart, you know, Amazon, of course. I love to mention bookshop.org, which is a nonprofit that shares revenues with local bookstores, which I like to support. And of course, you can also buy it from local bookstores. So it's on sale, and I'd love the support.
And I do want to mention all your information is on the show blog, getthefunkoutshow.kuci.org. And before we wrap up, I want to ask you, for anyone listening who's going through a really challenging time, or maybe their whole life has been challenging, if you could give one little tidbit of inspiration to keep going.
Yes. You know, we've all experienced hardships. I did too, which are shown in the book. And I think the key for me, all I can say is what works for me, is to be able to let things go, number one. I've really tried hard in life to let bad things go and not dwell on them to drag you down further, and to look at the world to the extent you can with wonder, which enables you, I think, to see what you do have instead of what you don't have, or to see the positives and not all the negatives. That's what's worked for me, so that's what I could provide.
I love that. A lot of times people write books because they have been through so much pain and suffering, and it comes across, but you seem like you've always been a very optimistic, half-glass-full kind of guy.
Yes, this is a book that has some bad things that happen, but it's not a misery book. You know, it is a happy book, an uplifting book that shows that kind of outlook and how it worked for me.
Well, congratulations on your book.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Keep me updated on other books, because I'm sure there'll be more.
All right. Thank you,
okay.
Janine.
Be well, Tom. That was Tom Seaman calling in to talk about his new book, Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. Within an hour after I wrap, I'll have a podcast of this episode on the show blog. Again, that is getthefunkoutshow.kuci.org. And if you want to find out about KUCI programming, from our music shows, public affairs shows, you can visit our website, kuci.org, and you can follow our socials at KUCI FM. We broadcast 24/7. We have a very eclectic mix of shows and talent here at the station. And if you want to find out about being a guest, you can send me an email to Janine, J-A-N-E-A-N-E, at kuci.org. We're going to take a little break, and then we'll be back. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.